The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 245 for Friday, the 17th of September 2010. My name is Jim Race. I'm here in California. Along with me, I've got one bleary-eyed Martin Darlington up at the crack of dawn in the UK. How are you, Martin?
I'm alive. I'm breathing. My eyes are kind of adjusting. The reading glasses are on. And it's windy and wet and grey, and it's definitely autumn.
Ah, you know, that's interesting, because I was thinking of our friends down in the Southern Hemisphere just before we got on this call. And, you know, I'm sitting here in a T-shirt and shorts, but I'm starting to eye the boxes and various things that I have my other clothing's in, because I can kind of feel it creeping on here. But you're in jolly old UK, where it's pretty much always winter.
yeah. we normally in a summer we'll get a couple of days of what might be described as summer.
True.
That was back in May, I think.
For a week.
But no, it's been a poor summer. It has.
Yeah. Well, then you guys had a hellacious winter. I've still got this picture that I have saved up of the entire aisle basically covered in white. It's certainly brutal. You've got you're up to some training this week, I believe.
Yeah, we've got today. We've got a crew resource management course, which we do every year, which basically involves, we normally have a case study of a crash and we talk it through and why did it happen, what was the chain of events. It's all about human factors. It's interesting. It's one of those things where a lot of stuff will come out of. It's all about, you know, crew communication, cooperation, and invariably most crashes that are caused by human factors, which is the majority of them, it's a chain of events. It's lots of little things that just come together in the wrong way at the wrong time. And should be interesting. And you normally start off with a little DVD of a compilation of various crashes, which bizarrely everyone finds quite entertaining, but in a sort of black humor kind of way.
Now, I know that you didn't plan that, and that probably just popped in your head, and I had no intention of asking you that question. But if you think about it, what we were talking about just before, it's a perfect, perfect segue for one of the interviews that we're going to have this week, isn't it?
Yeah.
I did get the opportunity, you guys all remember, or those of you that listened last week, that we had Mark Miller on prior to him running the Val d'Or at Magny-Cours Circuit in the World Endurance Championship. And he did indeed run that, and I spoke with Mark on Sunday evening, or actually I guess it was Monday morning his time, to kind of get his side of how the event went for him. And I will basically say, those of you that don't know, the team was unfortunately unable to finish the race, and so I highly suggest, if you not only enjoy listening to Mark, and I know a bunch of you guys do, but just take a listen to the interview. It's going to be very cool. And we also have another one. Jules Cisek, snapper extraordinaire and backstage guru, took over for on a conference call that I normally would do through Miller Motorsports Park. John Gardner out there puts together these great calls with Cal Crutchlow. And so we'll have a bunch of stuff from that. That should be great. I've got a good interview lined up for this coming weekend. Should be speaking with one or perhaps both, or not both, but two of the Laverty brothers. We'll see how that works out. And a whole bunch of stuff. I have managed to contract a cold. And Martin, you always sound like you have a cold, but let's see if we can't get into this. Oh, and by the way, thanks very much to Chris. I'm going to say Lowitz, and because he didn't respond to me quickly enough. Chris, also known as Hooper on the Weir board, thank you very much for a donation. Listener emails, you got the coolest one ever.
Yep, we had through the contact form on the MotoGPOD webpage, we had an email from Chris Phipps, who wrote in and said he's a British Army Air Corps pilot serving in Afghanistan, coming right to the end of his tour. And he said, is the Martin Darlington I can hear on this podcast the same Martin Darlington who also served in the Army Air Corps? Because it sounds like him, and if it was, Chris served with me as a door gunner back in the early 2000s. And so I was able to reply and say, yeah, it is. And it was really cool. And so nice one, Chris. And, you know, if you're not home already, welcome home when you get here. If you are, welcome home. And also just thought, you know, any other listeners who are out Sandyside in the Middle East, and, of course, Bob Hayes, co-founder of the podcast, is out there with the US Navy. So, hi, guys. And, you know, our thoughts are with you. Get home safely. And Chris was very complimentary in saying that, you know, he really valued the podcast because it kept him up to speed with what was happening in the racing world. And, yeah, it was a really, really cool email. It's like, wow, small world.
Yeah, yeah. And there is your perfect exposure, Martin, to how many people actually do listen to this show. And sometimes it just kind of blows me away, especially –
yeah,
you haven't gone through the whole face to face thing or voice to face, which is even weirder. But that was very cool, and I'm serious. I think that was probably one of the coolest emails we've had come across our path. So, you know, and I do have to. We always ask you guys to write in. And occasionally, I will admit that sometimes none of the three of us are actually able to get to them. And sometimes the ones that we have difficulty getting to are the ones that are so deep and intense and long that we're all kind of intimidated by it, or at least I am sometimes. So,
yeah, and I think sometimes you read an email, you think that deserves a lot of thought to reply. So I'll do that when I've got some time. And of course, you know, you've never got time. So
but yes,
you know, sometimes the most profound and thoughtful emails are the ones that struggle with reply. Well, I was thinking about this the other day with, I think it was one of Papathiam's, which I still haven't replied to. And I thought what I should do is say, you know, just reply with brilliant email, get back to you when I've had some time to think, you know.
You know, it's funny. He sent me a quick personal one. And I think I made some crack about him last week. And he said, you'll have to explain that joke to me. You'll have to explain that joke to me because I don't get it. But in the meantime, I'm just going to feel bitter to you. Something along those lines. and it did make me laugh. But no, you're exactly right, Martin. Those of you that write in some incredible screeds and we don't answer right away, please don't feel like you're being slighted. You're actually in an elite group of those that we pretend we know what we're talking about all the time. Sometimes we're just like, holy cow, that's incredible. And like anybody, we're pressed for time. So if you want to give us a friendly poke and say, hey, did you get that? Feel free. In the news. And this is kind of cool because this is, as I mentioned before, one of the people that we're going to talk to. But this week it was indeed announced that friend of the show and kind of a long time one, Eugene Laverty, is going to Starogardi Yamaha World Superbike in 2011. And I think we're all quite pleased for that. That, you know, that's kind of my fanboy, you and your helmet, Martin, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I thought when I heard that, I thought, oh, I'd kind of hoped that Eugene was going to go to Moto2, particularly if he got into Tech Trois. And then I thought about it more, particularly thinking back to James Whitlam's comments that, you know, and being able to interview him face to face and see his expression, and he's a very expressive guy, was real, real sort of appreciation of just how clever Eugene is. And James was saying, you know, it's not just his racing where he's clever. He's a meticulous, instinctively intelligent lad. And I thought about it and I thought, actually, this does make a lot of sense. He gets into the Yamaha stable, and they are a very progressive company, let's face it, you know, as far as promoting riders, giving them different opportunities. He can learn from and hopefully beat an established MotoGP rider in Marco Melandri, and he's not had a lot of superbike. I think he's had something like 60 laps on a superbike,
mm-hmm.
And that's it. So when you think about it, you think, right, so he's had 250cc GP experience in the last couple of years, World Supersport, and now he'll have had World Superbikes, and obviously if he's looking to move up to MotoGP, you know, a la Cal Crutchlow, Ben Spies, there's a bit of a natural progression developing with Yamaha. Of course, there'll be thousands in 2012, and he'll have had a wealth of varying experience. So I thought, yeah, clever lad.
Yeah,
I'm really chuffed.
Yeah, I am quite pleased as well. And for those of you out there that do listen to the cast early on Friday, and Martin, I know I said I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to. I think I'm going to have the opportunity to talk to Eugene this weekend. If you catch it on Friday, please send an email into race@motogpod.com if you have a question for me to ask Eugene. I'll pick two or three out of the ether and ask him. If it's after, say, Saturday afternoon, you listen to the cast, it's probably going to be too late. So hang on to that email or send in anyway and say, damn it, why didn't you let us know last week? But absolutely true. And, you know, I kind of wonder about one thing, or several things, actually, and it's kind of a sequence of events. Cal, I came from British Superbike. He was riding the HM Plant bike for a while, was he not?
Yeah, yeah.
He
partnered Leon Haslam in the HM Plant in 08.
Yeah, 08. And,
gross, yeah, 08, yeah.
And there was that great sort of massive Brit invasion of the final World Superbike race with a whole bunch of Brits coming over and running as wild cards at Port Mal, right?
Mm.
Remember that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it was race one, he actually, don't hold me to this, folks, but race one, I think he went down. Race two, actually, I think he was real successful. But that was kind of his, and I think at that point he'd already been announced to Yamaha World Super Sport. I can't say for sure, but regardless, the battles that he and Eugene had were clearly pretty epic, and Eugene is certainly on a fast track, although to my mind a little bit, it's kind of unfortunate that he doesn't have, you know, there's certainly a very high caliber of riders in there, but right now there is sort of a top three, and Eugene said it from the beginning of the year, even before the season when we talked to him. Be nice to have a few more guys up at the front, especially with Lescure's loss, with actually being out for a bit. But, you know, Eugene's going to that Yamaha team, and it would be great if he can have big success, because he had, like you say, he doesn't have a lot of time on a superbike, and be able to make the transition hopefully as quickly, maybe a year or two, however long it takes to grow into that bike and be ready to move on. And I certainly hope he does. And you're right. I think he's a sharp, canny kid. And
well, it's interesting you mention that about Cal, because, and this is a thought that's only just popped into my early morning head, so I haven't thought it through, and it's probably hoopla. But I do remember when Cal went to World Super Sport and the other influx of Brits went straight to World Super Bikes for 2009, there was a bit of a feeling of, oh, that's a bit disappointing, because Cal has always been an exciting rider to watch, and I think people thought, oh, that's a shame, he didn't quite make the grade for World Superbike. Now you look at it and you think, yep. Yeah, but hang on, he went to World Supersport, he's come to World Superbike, he's the one who's going to MotoGP for next season.
And so, for the most part, with the we've still got probably two guys that are at the top of their game, or close to it, which is Leon Haslam. Camier would be there too if he hadn't been injured, but certainly Johnny Ray. But somebody else that you thought from that exact same band of brothers, if you will, that went to Portimao in 2008 was Tom Sykes, and he's had a horrid time since then.
He has, but I think a lot of that, you got to look at the bike he's riding.
Well, but you have to say, Martin, he stepped into a good bike off the bat, and his teammate, now, granted, it was a bit of a evil measuring stick, but his team.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're thinking about last year on the Yamaha. Yeah.
So, you know, maybe the perfect career path was the super sport step. I usually don't engage in speculation until I fall into my own fanboy mode. Have you noticed? There, I've gone and done it. Anyway, best of luck to Eugene, and we'll try and talk to him this weekend and have something for you next week. And hopefully try and get Michael on as well, because I want to talk to him about his win last weekend. Might as well talk about that right now and toss it in. How about it?
Yeah,
I haven't watched yet, so you fill me and us in.
It was two cracking BSB races at Croft, and listeners may remember we were talking about this strange end to the season where Before Croft, after Cadwell, the top six were broken away into what they're calling the showdown or the title fight. So BSB official press announcements are referring to them all as title fighter Michael Laverty or Josh Brooks, etc. They went into it. Tommy Hill had a very good weekend, as did Michael Laverty. Race one, Tommy Hill came first. Michael Laverty came a close second. Of the other title fighters, Josh Brooks managed sixth, Richie Chiannari 11th. Michael Rutter had a horrible crash, and Alistair Seeley also crashed out. Race two was pretty much a carbon copy, with Michael getting the whole shot, then Tommy getting past, but this time Michael got back past. So Michael Laverty came first, Tommy Hill second, Keogh came fourth, Rutter fifth, Brooks eighth, and Seeley 15th. So at the moment, the championship is Tommy Hill is first with Michael second, because they started on a nominal 500 points plus 3 points for every top step of the podium, 2 points for second place and 1 point for third that they'd had throughout the preceding season. So there was a bit of variation. But really, really good start by Michael. And that's pretty damn impressive.
Yeah, he really hadn't been pegged for... He was kind of the dark horse. You know, there were one or two guys, and frankly, to make that step out of the box, and that's not even a fanboy thing. It's like, oh, okay, you know, this is not going to be, you know, a two-horse battle at this point. And so...
Well, the surprise was really the poor performance of the HM Plant Riders, Brooks and Chiannari, who everyone thought it was going to be, what we heard James Whittam say, really it's between Hill, Brooks and Chiannari. Mm-hmm. Well, Michael's just thrown a little fizzer straight into that equation. So, yeah.
It bodes great for the end of the season. So hopefully that will stay on, and certainly it's buoyed his spirits, and he's in just a fighting mode, so that'll be cool. What else is going on? Then we'll get to the Miller interview shortly. Valentino Rossi is going to have, at the end of the season, not unsurprisingly, some surgery to take care of that shoulder bash-up that he had doing some motocross last year. A lot of people are kind of freaking out about that. I don't think it's a big deal at all. There's an awful lot of guys that go under the knife at the end of the season, and I think it'll just be normal. The question is, will that interfere with winter testing? And we'll have to see. And, you know, frankly, if Yamaha does not release him, and whispers are that they may actually hold him till the end of, till, you know, the first day of 2011, then that's perfect. It's, you know, he's not going to be able to ride anyway.
Yeah.
And so it just might work out quite well.
Well, Masao Furuzawa has, there was an interview I read, I think, on GP Week, where he said, well, personally, I'd release him, and Yamaha would like to because of our good relationship with him, but it's a sponsorship issue, and you think, yeah, that's a convenient one to blame.
Isn't it?
The faceless sponsors.
Yeah. Well, yeah, God, kind of makes you wonder. That is silly, frankly. You know, it almost seems like schoolboy games, and I kind of wish they'd just deal with it and whatever. You also mentioned to me that... Cal is attend a private test on the M1 in Japan next month. That will be interesting, and I'm wondering what track they will use, because most of the solid tracks over there are owned by one or other of the major motorcycle manufacturers. I'm not sure how many test tracks Yamaha has. Anybody over in the Japan region? I know there are quite a few of you, not only expats, but folks that are native. Let us know if you hear about where they're going to be testing. I would be interested in that, and especially interested if you happen to be able to attend. And
yeah, now, the article I read, which was Michael Guy, I think, was indicating it's possible that there won't be any results publicized from that.
Well, that's why.
It will be a private, it will be behind closed doors, and that's just for their information only.
Well, so. Of course, Martin, that's why we're getting the army mobilized now. We did have a quick point of fact, and I just do want to point out, Martin and I are recording this on a Thursday morning for him, late Wednesday night for myself. So this is the news as of now. Loris Caparossi will not be running at Aragon. We reported last week that we thought he might, and that was sort of the sort of the talk of the potential paddock at that point, but the operation on his finger is not healed enough at this point. Now, what does that mean? We don't have any word on a potential replacement rider. And so until that happens, and you guys may know before this actually makes it out, it'll get edited Thursday night, out Friday morning. It will be interesting to see who they bring in. And I imagine...
With the state of play of their engines, they may choose to bring in nobody, I suspect.
You know, what they could do is bring in a test rider and a test bike if they could get it there quick. Well, they may not be able to. And let's speak of Aragon very briefly before we get to Mark's bit. Aragon is in the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
Andrew Wheeler, snapper extraordinaire for AutomotoPhoto.com, has been posting a fair amount of pictures, and I've kind of been following along. It's a beautiful landscape if you like high desert areas, and as I said to him, it reminds me of a relatively classic yet cult movie called Straight to Hell. Those of you that were into the late 70s, early 80s punk era might remember a few of the or many of the bands that actually appear in that movie. It is a spoof spaghetti western based pretty much in that area of Spain. It is out in the middle of frickin' nowhere, but it is a gorgeous, gorgeous track, reminiscent cornering-wise and elevation changes of Portimao, and everybody knows that I'm a massive fan of that track, and it's a track that all the riders like, and apparently all the riders are really looking forward to running here, too. And a whole bunch of people have been testing out there. So it should be cool. I'm actually really looking forward to this weekend. You know what? I just want a weekend with no drama, Martin.
Yeah, but we could do with a weekend of relatively close racing because we haven't been overly blessed with it recently in the Premier class.
Yeah, well, the nice thing is nobody's got nobody's really got any solid data. You know, some of the privateers and guys that were running in CEV and whatnot have already raced here, but nobody from the very top teams. Although I did think about this, you know, we talked about this last week about Rossi running on the R1. And there's actually a question that Jules asked of Cal, which you guys will find of interest when we run that in a bit, about Rossi running on the R1 and how much information they were able to get and transfer and use. And I kind of wonder if part of the thing about Rossi actually making changes to the electronics on the R1 wasn't a bit because he tested here last week on the R1, and I'm not sure whose it was, but I imagine that they certainly were going to be passing that data back to the Yamaha Stargarda World Superbike team, right?
Absolutely.
Is kind of a way to you know, a sharing of data. Regardless, World Superbike doesn't run at Aragon as of yet, but all of that kind of data is kind of interesting. Anyway, it should be fun. One of the pictures that I loved from Andrew was that the primary main road, apparently, into the circuit is still a dirt road, although a very wide one and nicely graded. It appears to still be dirt, much as Portimao was back in 2008. So a circuit under construction, but all we really care about is the circuit itself, not necessarily the entrance facilities. And I don't know, I'm excited.
Well, I just hope all the Spanish riders on their Repsol replica Fireblades wearing sandal shorts and flip-flops are careful when they're riding up the dirt track.
Yeah, indeed. It might be a good time to put on the wet weather tires. Man, you know, and there has been talk of weather coming in. Can you imagine a Spanish track, a dirt road going in and out, a deluge? Oh, my God.
That is going to be interesting.
That could be very, very interesting. I certainly hope the weekend is not marred by weather, or at least not marred unpredictably by weather. I have not gone through. Normally, I usually look at the weather report before I record these. I have not. Martin, if you want to carry on and talk about stuff, or at least lead, I'll tell you what. Let's lead us into Mark Miller's interview.
I was just very quickly going to say to people, which was something tweeted by Toby Moody, there is an extra free practice on Friday morning because it's a new track. So if people set their Tebows or Sky Pluses by time, do check your TV schedules and to make sure you pick up the change. There's also a change of sequence, I believe.
Okay.
So that's something worth just being a bit careful about.
Sure. And also for those of you that have MotoGP.com subscriptions, you'll have an extra bonus there in the morning, because we're usually not used to that, which means that all the teams are actually getting there pretty quickly. All right, so I'm going to check the weather, but in the meantime, let's fire up Mark Miller's relatively rambling bit with me from early Monday morning post Val d'Or. Roll it. Is this that guy? Are you massively bummed out?
Beyond words, yeah. I'm that guy. It turned out to be the worst possible thing.
But, so let me ask you a question, just a very base question. You knew you're gonna, you knew you weren't real happy with the Pirelli's going in, right?
We.
You got 4 hours on a tire. Let me ask you, actually, simply enough, when you were actually running on it, did you kind of get used to it as time was going on?
Yes.
Okay. And what, you know, the thing you're always looking for is, when is the tire really gone off? And in endurance, you know, 4 hours is a shitload of miles on that track. You're talking, what, that's 35, 70, about probably at least 120 laps, something like that, right?
Yeah, it's about 30 times four.
Okay. And did it give you any warning at all? Or did you get any warnings as time went on?
Not at all. That's what's so strange about it. They had changed the front tire at our fastest rider's request the first two rotations every 2 hours, because they've got semi-quick change setup. If they can change the front nearly as fast as the rear, they've got these cool little
jacks,
valves that come off and change the rotors right off. The calipers can be changed with new brakes in them.
Nice.
So they just zap the sucker off and drop them back on, and it's not like normal. You know, it's actually really quick. And they didn't do it for this last time, and I'm not blaming them. I'm just saying I had mentioned it to you, because 4 hours at the pace that we were running, which was actually red hot, you know, we were really smoking the lap times. I just mentioned it to you that, you know.
Yeah.
It probably, because I lost the front on the gas, which is strange. I kind of flicked into a chicane and grabbed the throttle, and it tucked at about 100.
Did the bike pull?
Yeah, I was watching it as it skid away from me, and I'm like talking to it. I literally was talking to it calmly as it slid away from me, and I'm like, that did not just happen.
Well,
and it hit the gravel, and I'm staring right, sliding on my ass, going, don't tumble.
It's
the frame. That's the only real reason why we couldn't really keep going, other than the front tire had also come off the rim, so I couldn't push it easy. And it was about, shit, half mile widths or more.
So what's your takeaway from the whole deal?
It was a terrific adventure. It was amazing.
There were a ton of people there, weren't there?
Yeah, actually, it was funny. I was just thinking about this, how I was getting a quick massage before the start of the race, because they had a professional masseuse there, which most of the teams, the big teams, have like two. But you really need it throughout the whole 24-hour race for the riders. When they get off the bike, they get a quick rub down. And I was like, well, I really want to watch the start of the race, because I was the second rider and the first rider was about to go. So I jumped up and ran to the front straightaway. And, you know, it was completely barren. There was people driving in for the whole morning. But when I first opened up that garage and went into the pit lane, the front grandstands was packed without an empty seat, and this is a Formula One racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
Could not believe it. I just started grinning from ear to ear. You know, it's just like, sick. You got to be kidding me. Yeah, it was good fun. Really, really good fun. It's just a bummer that I had to lose the front like that. And fuck.
Was that your second stint?
Third.
Okay. All right.
The funny thing is not so funny, is it was my last lap, and my lap times kept coming down. I was within a second of my fastest rider on the team. I had been, before the race, 7/10 off of his best and in the day, and a half a second at night before he put his qualifiers on for Super Pole, which we made. and which was awesome. And he did a freaking fantastic job. But this is an ex Grand Prix rider and World Supersport rider. And he'd been doing a lot of endurance races in the past on Pirelli. So I was kind of jonesing. I'm like, yeah, baby, you know, we're getting this. We're getting close. And I thought maybe by the end of the race, I might be either right with him or even nip him a little bit, which would have pissed him off, which would have been fun for me. But no, I was right when everything was working good. I'd gotten the confidence in the tires, and I was really sliding them. You know, we talked a little bit before about how the Pirellis feel so different than the Dunlops. They feel like you're riding on flat tires, like there's no air in the tires. It just slides and wobbles and wallows and everything. And they have a new rear tire, which is a 200, and we put the medium, which is supposed to have a little bit more stiffer carcass and like a Dunlop. And it instantly, I went from, you know, off in nowhere in the land to smoking, like really decent. Like I got the feel. And by the end of that third stint, after my 90th lap in race trim, I was just passing everybody but the fastest of superbikes. I mean, we had a couple safety cars, and we had this extremely long line of bikes from nose to tail for several laps. And as soon as the guy got off the track, the safety car pulled off. You know, it's basically short circuit. What is it called? Short circuit racing?
Yeah.
Sprint race. Sorry. You know, it becomes a head-to-head battle because everyone's there. And man, I mean, I caught every single dude, but like two at the front of this snake. And then one guy passed me. So in other words, we were like in about eighth-ish quickest out of 60.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were kind of in the super stock bike. So, dude, you know, it was all feeling good. And I can't believe that, like, just when you get to where you get the confidence and you could tell the team was happy just by the pit board, you could just feel it because the times kept coming down. And it's like, you know, P16, cool, no problem. We had P10 or L10.
Yeah.
9, 8, 7, 6. And when it got to 2, I'm like, well, this is brilliant. We're right back in the money because we had a little bit of an error at the beginning. We had brand new brake pads that were not bedded in and da, 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 da. My teammate pulled in right away. It's a long race. So you can actually, if you've got a problem, it's better to fix it because, you know, you'll make the time up. So we were already a little bit behind, but he had already made up a bunch. And then I had made up another bunch. And we did that 2 rotations. This is my 3rd total. And I had 1 lap to go. And I was halfway through the lap and I'm just like, yeah, no problem. Don't fuck it up. You know, like don't outbreak yourself and screw it all up. So I didn't outbreak myself. I did everything good. Went flying into this 4th gear chicane. I think you might backshift to 3rd. I just flicked it to the left and cracked the throttle and it tucked on the gas.
Hmm.
So, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. So I ran over the bike and it munched and the front tire was off. And so I'm like, you know what? Let's try to push it back. And you got to take all these access roads that zigzag around the racetrack. You don't get to just go on the race, you know, go straight back. You got to do all this other stuff. And I tried to push it for about 5 minutes. This is at the end of my hour,
right?
The last lap. So, I mean, I didn't have any energy as it was. I was about to fall off the bike and go lay down and take my shit off. And so now I crash. And so I tried to push the bike for 5 minutes and I couldn't. It was physically impossible. So I said, you know what? I don't know what to do here. I mean, I've got no front tire. The bike won't roll. The handlebars are smushed in and we are only at 8 hours. So we're not even halfway. So if I take an hour pushing this thing, shit, you know, it'd be okay. Maybe we even be somewhere to be able to remedy this. So I just kept getting back on the bike and then resting and back on the bike and resting. And at one point I just had to lay down. I was panting like a horse. It was just awful. And I thought to myself, you know what, dude, you're not going to quit. I almost did. I even told the guys once, I said, I can't do this. It's physically impossible. I cannot push this thing a half mile like this with no front tire on it. Yeah. And in the gravel with this exhaustion. And I just rested another 3 minutes and said, you know what, I'm not giving up. There's no way I'm going to live the rest of my year knowing that maybe if I could just go back and try it again, I would have done it, damn it. And so I kept going. And it wasn't until I got near the backside of the pits, across the front straightaway from the pits, that our chief mechanic, it was our crew chief, Gordon, Flash Gordon, he's not allowed to get close to the bike and no one's allowed to help you push it is the rules. which is a totally different animal and super fun and like really cool to learn a new set of rules. It's endurance racing. You know, the rider can push the bike back to the pits under his own power, and the mechanics are not allowed to touch it until you cross the pit start line lane. So he's looking at the bike and assessing it and seeing how hard it was for me to push it because there was no front tire. It was wobbling on and off the rim. And I was like down underneath the tank with one arm and the other one trying to steer the bike, pushing and heaving like a horse, like, you know, pulling a something in the field as hard as I could push the thing. And finally he says, this and that. He's looking at it and he says, oh, the frame's cracked. He says, dude, that's it. You don't need to push it anymore. So it was his call. So personally, I'm like, well, at least I tried to overcome this and it didn't work out. But I tell you what, I have never felt so bad in my life. There's 20 crew members and three riders and a masseuse and like a cook. And I mean, this is a mega, major effort. And to be the guy that was on the bike when it crashed hard enough to not continue, I literally cried. Like I couldn't help but be so emotional because it was the end of a long journey.
But you know what though? It doesn't sound like, at least in what I would consider my definition, you were that guy. You just happened to be the guy that was on the bike when the bike went down because you put everything you had into it and you gave it that Herculean effort to try and get it back to the paddock. If you'd sat your ass down and said, oh, you know, fuck this, that's a deal. It sounds like you gave it the best that you had and circumstances did not allow you to continue. You know, it could have slid in the gravel and just scuttered along and scraped up the fairings, but no, it caught and it flipped.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. It's just, you know, it's just kind of like the last lap I was like coming in and it was a bit of a thing where we had worked ourselves back up to, I think, fourth place in Superstock, which means we would have had the podium because we were faster than all but one team ahead of us, which was the factory Suzuki team. And we're a private BMW team. You know, we've got a little bit of backing, but it's very little. And, we were in the top, 13 overall out of 60 at that point. So the thing was that we had made up all this ground and it was sort of like, anyway, I appreciate you saying that, but it's still, I just wish it wasn't me.
Well, that is completely understandable. All right. Well, you know, just something learned. And, you know, frankly, I'm glad that you got that experience and more than a little jealous. Regardless of the circumstances, I knew it was going to be fun. And you were going to, when you were kind of had that attitude as, you know, it's a little race. I'm like, oh, this dude's in for it. He's not even going to know.
It's the coolest thing I've done in a long time. I guess since the electric bike thing, this is really new. And it's 24 hour race and there's huge teams behind this. Like there's big factory efforts.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and the GMT 94 guys, that were up there near the top. One of them on the team is a regular listener and talk to him all the time. Yeah, no, Le Mans 24 hours on my bucket list. I hate that term. God, I hate that term. But
I know, right? There's a story, though, that's supposedly true, and I still cannot believe it. But if you want to say don't be that guy,
yeah.
One of the teams, the team that was leading at the halfway point.
BMP.
I don't know.
Yeah, the BMP Elf 99 guys, they were on the other Beamer.
Yeah, the 99 bike was leading, and they crashed near the end. But apparently, the team that was also leading at one point was still in the top three on the final lap. And we're talking about 1,000 crew members up on their pit boxes at the wall, looking for their rider, giving them the one more lap. Dude, oh my God, 24 hours of this shit. We've been awake for 2 days. And here you go. The bike didn't break. We didn't crash it bad enough to continue. And the guy crosses the start-finish line for the final lap, a minute and 40 left. The guy crashes and breaks his collarbone from the podium.
Yeah, I shouldn't even laugh. That sucks. But
can you imagine that guy sitting in the hospital tonight with a sore shoulder and looking at the ceiling? Just going,
you know what? You can take solace from that. Now, he is that guy.
Oh, that's terrible. Well, you know, we've talked about sort of like the universe works in weird, mysterious ways, as you like to hear all the time. And the one good thing that if you can take out of any of this is because we didn't have to do the rest of the race, all the crew members, and like I said, it's literally 20 men, 20 guys, said, hey, let's walk over to the campgrounds and just have a look around. And we walked over there, and I have never seen anything like this in my life. It was a war zone in a good way. They had cars on fire. They had motorcycles revving to the limit, blown, doing techno.
I just saw a picture on Flickr, and they do this in Spain too, of a motorcycle with big ass megaphone hooked up to its exhaust system on a trailer, and they'll just sit there and rev the piss out of it all night long.
Dude, it was dirty and grungy. And the thing is on the even on the racetrack, there was so much smoke crossing the racetrack from the pits, from the campgrounds, that at one point I couldn't quite see the kink. This is the fastest kink in there, probably 180 plus mile an hour, and it was still in the daytime. And I'm like, you know, I can't actually see the next where we're braking yet. It was like so smoky that all the bikes were black in soot by the end of the 24 hours. So, but it was so much fun. And at night, you know how it is when you turn on your brights in the fog,
yep.
You can't really see that good, but it's still kind of fun. Well, we had red taillights from all the race bikes in front of you. And then you've got everybody with armbands on, either blue, white, or red. And so all their arms are illuminated by your headlights. And the other bikes had like green stripes and different lights, yellow and yep. Cool stuff. So we had this massive light show, like out of, Close Encounters of the Third Kind or something, that's even more enhanced because of the smoke from these crazy people that were actually going mad. And my girlfriend's French, and she had never seen anything like that before. She went with us back to the campgrounds, and she's like, this is not my France. You know, like, I didn't know people in France would even act like this, but it was super fun. So that was the one good thing, is we all kind of went out and blew off some steam with these crazy nuts.
So you want to go back?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know if I'll be invited back after crashing this thing, but they seem to be kind of like, dude, it happened. You know, like nobody was giving me any grief. They were just like, you know, this is endurance racing and it could have happened to anybody. And there, I kid you not, I put down somewhere that it might have been 45 crashes from everybody. Yeah. It's probably more like 70 or 80 crashes from all the teams combined in the 3 days. Yeah. It was insane. There was scratch marks and oil marks and yellow flags nearly every lap. Like, everybody was crashing. There wasn't hardly a bike that finished that didn't crash once. It was just, I don't know if it was the grip of the racetrack or what. And even some of the veterans were like, you know, this is pretty unusual. You don't really see this many crashes. And they were everywhere.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the hell happened with me, but all I know is I wasn't the only one.
You had plenty of company. Well, yeah, there certainly were, and I was. They had an update through like Moto Racing Live or something.com, and I saw that one guy had some fairly serious injuries, some cranial injuries. But they left it just at that, and you don't know how bad that is, because it can sound horrid or can just be fine with a concussion or so. But yeah,
kooky. Could be a lot worse, is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, exactly. It could be. There were multi-bike crashes. Somebody threw down a bunch of oil out there, I guess, going into turn two, I think, and about five bikes went down in that.
The final corner before the front straightaway-ish, the second to the last corner, which is downhill, hard braking, where one of the factory Yamahas last year, not Spies, but his teammate Sykes, I think it was, he low-sided in 09. Anyway, there was oil laid down there at least on three occasions. Like, they had to stop, they had to do the safety car and fix, and then you're like on the brakes downhill on dry, what is that called? Dry something?
Dry sack.
Sand, like,
yeah.
How much confidence can I have on this? You know, like, it took a while to kind of get back on the line, but it was really cool, man. It's talk about endurance. I mean, that's a good word for it. It really is an endurance situation where you just have to sort of finish.
Speaking of which, and we've been chatting about your physio, and the 24-hour full would have really tested that, but how'd the hour stints go? No problem?
Dude, to be completely honest with you, it was what I had expected, which was I got stronger every hour.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what it is. You kind of get through this phase where, you know, at the TT, you get arm pump on the first lap or two, and then for the last four, you're holding on for dear life over those bumps, and you just kind of get stronger. You don't get weaker. You get better.
I was just going to say, I mean, as you came to terms with the bike and the tires, maybe it allowed you to relax. Being able to relax on a bike is actually a fairly easy way to go quicker.
Yeah, you're not holding on so tight. And like you said, holding on and not knowing exactly how this bike is supposed to slide, because it was sliding more than anything I've ever ridden before, the way it was sliding. But I learned the Pirellis. Last week I was really mean to Pirelli and said that I thought they were not so good in 17-inch. Last week I was a bit harsh on Pirelli because I just really didn't know how they work. But once you get to know how they work, you don't have to hold on so tight, and they really slide. Like, it's kind of fun once you know what they're supposed to do. If you were sliding a Dunlop like the Pirelli slide, you'd probably be crashing, or that, or your tire is just completely shot. But my whole point is that, man, these Pirellis that do slide like this, it's kind of fun because you just trail down on the front and you crack the throttle on this big 1000 and you just slide the sucker all the way out of the corner, like almost into the next corner before you hit the brakes again. So it's a different style, but it's not like I think I was kind of mean last week, you know, talking about Pirellis not being so hot. But I think once you kind of get the hang of them, they're not so bad.
I ran Dunlops for pretty much the entire time I raced, and I tried Pirellis on a Lark once, ran down at Button Willow with them, and I experienced almost the exact same thing. And I ran, in as you would say, in my shitty little world of racing, I ran them, I was running a small displacement bike, a 250, and so it really wasn't that big a deal. And so if you didn't, you know, I didn't run multiple races over race weekend, so I actually ran them for two race weekends. And I did have a crash on them, but I can't attribute it to the tires, because I know that I went in that particular turn two at Buttonwillow, a gear too hot. And but you're absolutely right as far as their difference over the Dunlops. They slide, but they slide in a really predictable manner that is fun.
Yeah, for sure. Especially if you got the suspension set up. I think if you're a little too soft on the spring, it'll pogo. It'll tend to fight the tire. It'll kind of go won't, 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 and it'll keep kind of going from tire to spring, tire to spring. But I think once you can get the thing to really just step out and stay there, you can. It's so different, man. You just throw the thing down and just roll on that throttle and kick the rear end out, and you're like, damn, am I supposed to be doing this? And apparently you are. You know, that's how you do it.
I looked for pictures from, because there's a ton of them on Flickr, and I was trying to find any of you guys. I haven't found them yet, but if you find any, you'll have to send them to me. I'd love to see some.
Yeah, sure.
Cool.
Just one more quick thought on what we're talking about, not white knuckling it, and you get a bit stronger as a long race progresses and you actually feel stronger is, you know, obviously we're learning the tires, but we're also learning the racetrack. You're also acclimating to speeds that, you know, when you're kind of thrown in the deep end, you're trying to learn as much as you can without making big mistakes. So you sort of ease into it. And I just wanted to kind of mention something that I think we've all experienced, and that is the first time you go down the ski slope after a year off, you know, you're sucking and you feel like it's way fast and violent. But after the second day of your holiday, you're actually quite flying. The same experience over here. There's a lot of really hard braking sections on this MagnaCore racetrack where you're just sort of, you know, topped out or going downhill, like I mentioned before. And the first couple, several days even, trying to get up to speed at this place without, you know, screwing it all up, I was white knuckled. Like, I could not believe how fast I felt like I was going to overshoot the corner every single time. But after a couple hours of riding the track, I was like, what was I worried about? Like, you can fly, you can go down in here so deep. Like, all these guys were passing me on the brakes early on in the week. And I'm like, how in the hell are they making the corner? By the time I was about to crash, I could see exactly what they're doing, and it was not even that big a deal. So it's just weird how it's the same bike, it's the same weight, it's still you, it's all in your mind.
And we talked about this a couple of times ago when we talked, is that the difference between the way that you ride a short circuit and the real roads is quite a bit different, because on the real roads, you're always leaving yourself a certain margin of error. On the short circuit, when you've got this runoff and you got gravel traps and, you know, and all that stuff, you can approach the edge that much closer. Perhaps that is what you had to work up to. The question being, at a certain point, is when is enough enough? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I tell you, I've been hearing that kind of statement for a few years now, that you always leave a little bit in reserve on the roads, and the short circuit stuff is a little bit different. And I didn't really quite understand it again until this weekend, getting back on a short circuit with any length of time. it is such a refined thing. I mean, you really find every extra inch of braking, every, you know, bit of front traction, and every, you know, trail braking is what I mean, every kind of little tiny thing. And it's a real fine art. I mean, it's a really fine, it's a fun process. It's not like the roads, you really got to keep a flow and you're trying to stay alive and stuff like that. And you do brake really deep on the roads and stuff like that. But it's because it's so bumpy and it's changing and different kind of things, there's that margin of error. Out here, the fast guys are just at the edge of physics. You know, they're right at the geometry of the arcs of the lines of the needed for the racetrack to promote the best drives and the biggest brakes. But it took me a couple days, you know, to get back to where I thought I was competitive in that, in those little small envelope. And it was really fascinating. It's really, really different, really cool.
What did you think of the circuit itself?
It's great. I mean, it's really cool. It's not as easy as I thought it would be. Like I thought, well, I don't know what I thought, but all I know is it was a lot of places to crash. Like there was a lot of opportunities to fall down. The guys that fell off and got really hurt on one occasion, it was a fast section and it was kind of a weird deal. Either the guy high sided or he tried to pass a slower rider and maybe the guy drifted out on him and punted him off. But it was kind of a strange place to crash. And I don't even think the wall was protected, but it was ugly. I mean, it was like they were down. We were on the safety car for several, you know, minutes on that one. But the track is kind of dangerous in places. To be fair, my teammate who fell in the wet on the very first day on Wednesday's practice, he high-sided coming off the big fast turn two onto the fastest straightaway, and he kind of high-sided late straight up and down, and he hit the fucking wall, and the bike hit the wall, and it's 50 yards away. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're going in the rain, you accelerate when you hit the ground. You don't slow down.
Yeah.
So he hit his head. Matter of fact, my friend, the same guy, I think he's Slovakian, ended up crashing himself. I think he backed himself into a high side on the brakes on the second day. And you will not believe this, Jim. This kid who's under 30, he did not strap on his helmet.
Oh, shit.
And they have photographs of it. And he's high siding 4 meters in the air, whatever that is. I don't know what that exactly is, 4 meters, but it's high. And his helmet comes off midair.
Holy crap.
And he comes down with no helmet. And he's guffed himself. He knocked his head. He's so lucky. So very lucky. He knocked his eye. You know, one side of he's got a black eye and his ear is bloody. And he's got lost some hair from the whatever it's called, the road rash on his head. And he couldn't move. Like, he's so bruised. He couldn't ride. He was our second fastest rider to start off with. And we were really bummed to lose him. But he couldn't get himself out of bed. He didn't have any broken bones, and he had no CAT scan problems. He had a massive concussion, but he could have physically ridden, but he couldn't move, so he couldn't ride. So that's quite a story.
Did you bring the fourth guy that was originally testing with you then?
Well, we started with the fourth guy that originally tested with us, but he was a couple. He was, you know, not quite getting up to speed yet, and so they asked his permission to draft the Swiss team's fourth guy, who had been doing some pretty decent lap times as their reserve. And once their three riders were locked in, we stole him and punted our fourth guy and put a better fourth guy, who's now our third guy, who actually it ended up doing the same exact lap times.
Okay.
So we had a fast guy ringer. We had me that was catching up, which wasn't too far off, but I was still, you know, every lap I was a little slower than him. And then we had the slower dude. So we were kind of, and he was getting faster, and it's just a fascinating thing, you know, like you got three riders riding the same motorcycle. That's quite unusual, and it's three different setups. I mean, if in a perfect world, you'd have three different motorcycles. Well, this is one motorcycle, and the fastest guy's kind of got the most clout to change the bike to his settings, which went in a direction at one point that it didn't help me. It actually made me have less confidence in the rear. And eventually, we kind of compromised, which, again, is, I guess, this type of racing. It's a compromise, and he wanted the lever really high up, and I'm like, dude, you're crazy. Like, I can't even hardly press on the brake lever if it's this high. It's stupid stuff like that, you know.
What was the disparity in body types? Were you guys fairly close, or
at the beginning it was about the second fastest kid who got hurt was my size, and I'm built about like Matt Mladen. You know, I'm a medium guy. I'm not a little guy, and I'm not a tall, lanky dude. I'm kind of right in the middle.
Yeah,
and he was as well. And then the fastest guy is a little smaller, but he might, I mean, he's a little, I don't know how old he is, but I think he's, yeah, anyway, it doesn't matter. We were close. One guy was a little smaller, but our original four guy was an Amazon. I mean, the dude was a basketball player and he wasn't even that thin. So we're like, that's big disparity.
Yeah.
And then our replacement rider was now a skinny, tall kid who was probably more my weight, just a little longer in the legs and that kind of stuff. So we were kind of close in the very end, but yeah, it's a very different thing. You're not so selfish. You know, you really honestly have to learn how to not be so selfish.
Yep, yep. The tune of the bike, did the thing go?
It was a missile. These BMWs are so fast, it's unbelievable. Like, I can't even believe. I was asking them because they had changed the motor for the race, and so they had the airbox off and the fuel injection units off. And so I just, you know, I moved their little suction cups off the intake ports before they drop the engine, just to look at what the hell they're doing. This BMW is so powerful that they're saying that you can practically not even make them faster, you know, for superbike. So I'm looking down the ports and it looks pretty normal, kind of, you know, a little bit behind the BMW, not a Suzuki. So it's a, you know, German, I mean, they make M7s, you know, M5s, like the BMWs did Formula One. They're not stupid. You know, they can make an engine. And I'm like, why is this thing so fast? He says, well, they're, you know, these are German guys, so they're speaking with this very, very broken English in German accent, which is fun talking about a BMW with a German that knows what he's talking about. And he says the camshafts are very aggressive, and they've had to make it streetable, barely, with the electronics package. And there's also, what, the ABS, and there's also the TC, there's traction control. But it's a race motor, and there's a billet or a drop-forged billet, something, a combustion chamber, and the pistons are really light and they're super high quality. So it's basically just super bike parts.
So in the super stock class, do you run the stock electronics or aftermarket?
We are on a kit map from BMW factory on the initial street ECU.
Okay.
But there's no resemblance. Apparently it's quite an ordeal to change. It takes, I don't know if it takes an hour, but I'm telling you, the guy was, when he originally did it to my friend's bike at the TT, he was in there 45 minutes just programming the stock ECU. And they can also put in the speed limiter for the pit lane.
Yep.
So, and it's adjustable, but again, it took him 25 minutes to adjust the speed down because it would pop the 60 mile an hour thing at one point. And I kept telling him, I said, you know, it's too close. It goes right up to 60 and then it goes 61, 62 and back to 60. I said, you put the thing at 55. Like, why are we risking a 30 second penalty? So they ended up doing it. But anyway, it's stock electronics with a bunch of tweaking, but it doesn't have a piggyback power commander. It has the stock shifter, the electric shifter that comes on the street bike. Every race bike I've ever seen uses the stock unit because it has something to do with probably the resistance or the ohms or the, it all works together, and you can't just throw a power commander or a shifter on there because it's just, it would screw it all up. It's all very sensitive. Like, we even have the key removed, which is legal for the weight and stuff. We don't have a key on it, but they had to actually like electrical tape all the innards of the key, even if it's completely not used. And it's, you know, it's like that with the Suzuki a little, but we had to carry on board basically every single thing that came on the street bike, or we'd screw up its brain.
Right. Right.
That's what I was told. I don't know everything. I'm just talking out my ass, but this is what I'm the gist of what I'm getting from everybody that I talked to.
Well, it sounds like whatever they did was working for you. And frankly, that's all that really matters, especially in a super stock class. I mean, and I kind of have to wonder, you know, what, like, you know, the Elf 99 guys, what more they have. Clearly they do have something. Granted, they've got a great bunch of riders, but their lap times were really impressive when they were in ideal conditions.
Yeah, I think they had better riders, and I also think they had lighter bikes with the 16.5, the big Brembo monoblocks. I was talking to Steve Martin, who, you know, yes?
Yep.
He was telling me, you know, I don't know, I kind of hope this isn't a secret, and don't edit it, because you took out the John Hopkins bit last week. There was a fun rant about that, well, and you took it out.
Yeah, I'll tell you offline why I took that out.
Come on, now, like, it's not going to ruin him or anything, you know? It's actually, it's lore. It should become legend. The guy's a rock star, you know? Hopkins is a cool cat.
Yeah, there's no doubt. You know what? I'll hang on to it, and it just might leak into something someday. You never, you know, I that was the first interview that I've ever done with you where I edited something out. Actually.
Yeah.
I feel guilty all the way through. I'm like, oh, fuck, man, I don't want to.
It's such a funny thing. Like, I mean, this poor 17-year-old kid with tattoos all over him is like, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So you were going on about the Elf 99 team.
It's just the super bikes are a little bit lighter. They got better grip. They got lighter wheels. They got better forks, the better brakes. I mean, they literally are just a little bit better chassis, and I think that the electronics could be quite a bit better. Our traction control didn't seem to even turn on once. At the TT, it was going, the little light was flashing like mad. Here, I couldn't get it to turn on once. So I think their electronics are still more advanced than our stock BMW stuff. But in a straight line, my BMW super stock had every single person either matched or completely covered. I didn't see a Suzuki GSX-R 1000 out there that I didn't blow by 10 miles an hour. I mean, I had to literally really be careful not to run into the back of them through the kink, because, you know, that's the worst thing you do is try to slow down from 110, or let's say 180 down to 170. You can't do it. It almost takes forever. So I would have to pick my line and just hope to God that he didn't change his, because my bike was so much faster than the other super stock bikes. It was a joke. So, but as far as the super bike guys go, they'd come off the corners real fat and just like, I'd kind of, I'm still there. And once I got pointed straight up and down, I could almost catch them. Like it was just pulling me. But you guys, if you guys want a motorcycle that's quick for the street, go buy a BMW S1000RR, because it is the shit. There's nothing that can touch it. And our bike is stock. There's nothing you can do. There's no cam timing adjustments. There's nothing. We had the stock spark plugs, because we showed up to the TT, and I'm like, hey, man, it's like, I got the Iridium spark plugs. You know, we got the base gasket on there. We got the cam timing. It's all legal for super stock, you know? And I wanted to do all this modifications, buy a light battery for it and all that. They're like, dude, shut the fuck up. You don't understand. Like, Toy Courser's got this motor in his super bike. You know, I'm like, kind of.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, and it's true. I mean, I've ridden one now for half a year, and it's they're bullets. But anyway, I'm rambling on again. The only thing is those bikes got better chassis, I think.
Where did the frame crack anyway?
Yeah, right across the top upper motor mount. You know how you've got sort of the top ones on up,
yeah,
up, and then you got the lower ones. It's right across that frame, man. It's a line. It's a little thin crack. It's just cracked. And I'm like, is there no way we can, you know, can you fix it? Can you do this? He says, no, you can't. It's like, you're done. You can't even repair it, because it's supposed to flex a certain way. And if you ever put any kind of stresses on that section, that's not designed to do, because these frames are built, you know, to flex now.
Yeah. So they don't have JB Weld. They don't have JB Weld in France.
Shit, I would have got a Pepsi can and cut out a little square and then put the JB Weld between the Pepsi can and the frame and went racing. But no, it was toast. Well, I mean, anything shy of that, we would have done it. Even a change of motor, we could have done, you know?
Yeah. I mean, frankly, that also could have been cumulative too, because that bike saw the ground more than once, right?
Yeah, there was two. I mean, again, out of the two bikes, we crashed five times in 4 days, which is unheard of. Like there were some circumstances. My boy crashed in the rain once. He crashed. Oh, and there was one crash on the front straightaway where we had a little error with, there was just a problem with the steering. I was on the thing and the steering stopped working for.
Once again, many, many thanks. I don't even have to thank Mark. Actually, Mark, I think we kind of talked each other into doing that. It was very early for him on Monday morning. It was late-ish, and I was kind of tired on Sunday. And we were like, should we do it? Yeah, what the hell? And it's kind of clear that we're just kind of chatting away. So hope you guys enjoyed that. Martin, you'll get to hear it on Friday, because I haven't pulled it together yet. Yeah. In the meantime, I did go ahead in that break while Martin and I were chatting about this and that, and took a look at the weather for Alcanyes, I hope I pronounced that properly, I'm sure I mangled it, for the next few days. And so Friday, probably when this cast comes out, we're looking, this is the current forecast, mind you, and from a single site, so please don't hold me to this. We're looking at an 80% chance of rain, temperatures in centigrade, 24 high, 16 low, mild winds on Saturday. 45% chance of rain, 22, 13, but a bit of a breeze, 18 kilometers steady throughout the day. Sunday is looking at a 25% chance of rain. Temperatures continue to drop over the next 4 days, down to 23-9. So Sunday is going to be iffy. Let's hold it. Hope that the weather holds. And frankly, having Saturday and Sunday with lower chances of rain gives us the opportunity to see everybody. If things stay stable, we'll have to see. I'm a bit of a weather geek, Martin. You have to be too, because you fly all the time.
Yeah, and it is a consideration for Aragon. If it's wet on a brand new track, not scrubbed in,
oh, that place
is not familiar with it, that's going to be a lottery.
That place is scrubbed, Martin. They've been running tons of races there. They've not had MotoGP rubber down, but CV runs there.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I guess the track's been running for a while, but certainly unfamiliar in the wet will be.
Yeah, and well, as we were joking, if they do get the deluge and that dirt road going in and out, and rabid Spanish fans, at least the ones that wanted to trek out to the middle of nowhere where there's no hotels in sight, could be interesting. All right, what else is going on, sir?
Well, it's the 2011 calendar, provisional calendar, has slipped out, and MotoMatters.com, friend of the show, David Emmett, has posted the provisional one up. We're looking at a slightly earlier start to the season in Qatar, looking at 20th of March, which is a relief because that was a long, closed season last year. We're expecting an official announcement this weekend. What's interesting is they'd put it out to some of the people like Pole Position Travel and Big Rock and the ticket booking agencies, obviously to give them a heads up so they can start planning. And some of them had happily slapped it on their website. So it was like, don't. But yeah, so the provisional calendar is out there. And Sharon and I have already been looking down going, right, where can we go? Where can we go? So more news. We still haven't heard whether Jorge Lorenzo signed for Yamaha. And I'm thinking, come on, guys. Yamaha need him. They've lost Rossi. They need what looks like he's going to be this year's world champion. But then Jorge needs Yamaha because realistically, he ain't got no place else to go. So just sign the damn contract.
I think that's a bit of fanboy whinging, Martin. You know he's going to sign it.
Yeah. it just leaves a little bit of a, no matter what the detail is, and obviously it's all very confidential and not going to talk about it, it just gives ammunition to people who are saying he'll presume it's just based on money and greed and all the rest of it. And I think, come on, you're not going to be short of cash. So whatever the dispute is over, let's just get it done.
I think you're reading the motorcycle racing tabloids too much, Mark.
Yeah, probably.
Frankly, it probably is already signed, but it certainly is of value for them to keep the suspense up, because it keeps people like us and people like everybody else talking about it. And all of that is good for the sponsors. It's good for keeping this stuff in the news. It's been a while that I've kind of gone, I'm pretty sure something's going to happen. I'm like, okay, we'll just wait for it to happen. And now that being said, I have, I've missed a boat or two as time has gone on, but
yeah,
we shall see. World Superbike, World Supersport, not unsurprising. In fact, it was kind of a non-bombshell, if you will, because the way that it was announced was kind of like, woo, Johnny Ray rejoins with Tenkata. But the funny thing is he already did have another year on his contract. And so now with Crutchlow and Laverty on the Sterlegaard Yamaha team, that, of course, doesn't leave a whole lot of room for
Melandri and Laverty.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did say that. That was my dream team. That would have been really cool. Boy, talk about trying to beat your teammate. It doesn't leave a lot of room for JT52 James Toslin. The piano man is probably looking for a chair before the song ends up. And we've kind of been wondering, we were thinking, perhaps Tenkata. We don't know if there is or isn't going to be another seat available over there. There has been word, as you mentioned, Martin, about BMW, though Leon Haslam.
I mean, a lot of this is coming from Roger Burnett, who's James's manager, and it's in his business to, make it appear that James has lots of options, so someone might snap him up. Although the report did say that if Leon Haslam's team manager is currently in Japan speaking to Suzuki and basically, I think, saying, look, all the factory support you promised us this year, which hasn't continued the way it started, are we going to get it next year? Because if not, we might lose Leon. and I think Leon would be most teams' first pick. So Leon could possibly gazump James to the BMW seat, or another bit of speculation in the motorcycling tabloid press was that possibly both of them would go and Troy Corsa would find himself out of a job. I doubt that somehow, because I think he's developed it. He's been the lead in developing it, and he's had some pretty good results, if a bit inconsistent. But, hey, it's Troy Corsa.
Yeah, I think Troy's going to go when he wants to go. And, frankly, there are a couple of tracks that he runs really well at, and he's still a good representative, frankly, for the brand. And I think the last thing you want to do, although this seems to be the theme, frankly, if you think about it, since the since Yamaha revised the R1, is to, you know, swap the whole team every year.
And, of course, we've got Norrie Harker and Michel Fabrizio looking for a ride.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I've heard a few things about Norrie, and there's nothing even close to positive. And, you know, your guys' speculation is as good as mine. I've got no idea exactly. I have no idea even partially what's going to happen there. And I do have some people on the inside. Nobody's talking. Come on, you guys.
No.
Talk.
And then Aprilia came out with quite an amusing statement saying that they've halted the development of the RSV4 for the remainder of this season to allow Max Bianchi to concentrate on winning the title without the risk of a new part being fitted and then failing. And I thought, so you've got a lot of faith in your engineering then. Well, I see the sense of it. I see the sense of it.
The verbiage is amusing because clearly they've halted. Let me rephrase that first sentence. Aprilia have halted the delivery of development parts of the RSV4 because clearly they're not going to sit on their laurels, which they don't quite have yet, but look like they're aiming to. For the, you know, still there is still time, but I'm sure that they're working on the bike, and certainly now that the gear driven top end has been essentially outlawed for next year, unless they actually homologate a unit with that in it, you know that they're cranking away on the midnight oil and putting together a bike that will basically keep them at the top. It's first, you know, has Aprilia ever had, oh yes, they did. They had a World Superbike Championship with, I want to say, Corser back in 2003 on the RSV Mille, I believe it was.
They didn't win, did they?
They may have. I know they certainly had some wins with that bike. Once again, MotoGP OD fans, pepper us with our failing memory.
Because 03 was Colin and Troy, wasn't it? It was that epic.
That was 02.
02.
Yeah. It was back then, 04 maybe. I don't know. It was a twin. Ugh, I completely botched this, and I blame it all on the cold medicine. What else do we have, Martin? You know, I think what we should do at this point is go ahead and run the Cal Crutchlow interview and conference call that Jules Cisak did with. Thank you very much for the folks at Miller Motorsports Park putting this together with Cal Crutchlow.
Good morning, everybody. Well, we're back for another Miller Motorsports teleconference with riders in the Hans Spree Superbike World Championship. And today we're pleased to have with us Cal Crutchlow, who rides the number 35 Yamaha YZF R1 for the Yamaha Cyril Garter team. Cal, of course, won both ends of his home race at Silverstone last month, and he's been on the podium 7 times this season and has 5 poles. In 2009, he was the World Supersport Champion before graduating to the Yamaha World Superbike team this year. He's currently 5th in the championship with 217 points behind Max Biaggi with 397, Leon Haslam with 339, Jonathan Rea with 288, and Carlos Cech with 224 heading into the penultimate race of the season at Nürburgring on the 26th of this month. And as you all probably know, Cal has been chosen to move up to the Monster Energy Tech 3 MotoGP team for next year, so we have quite a bit to talk about. And Cal, welcome, and we thank you for being here with us today.
No worries. Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me along.
So here we are. We've got 2 races in the left to go in the season, 4 races total, and you are 5th, and you're just about 7 points behind Cheka. What are your objectives for the remainder of this season?
Well, I suppose I always said, you know, moving into World Superbike is going to be difficult, so to finish in the top 6 in the first year was my plan, and I'm exceeding that expectation at the minute because I'm 5th, and as you said, 7 points off 4th. I hope to grab that fourth in the championship, I suppose, in the last four races. It's going to be difficult. Carlos Checa's the ex-MotoGP winner and World Superbike race winner, and the boys at the front are not going slow this year. So if we can, if I can grab fourth, I'll be ecstatic, and it'll be good to move into MotoGP on good terms and holding my head high, I suppose.
It's your first year and your only year in World Superbike. What has surprised you?
Quite a lot, really. Moving from Super Sport, the bikes are not so different, you know, riding a motorbike, I suppose, but the competition in World Superbike is a lot. The depth of field, you know, one week you can be 15th and next week you can be winning. And, you know, I remember Valencia this year, in qualifying, 0.2 seconds covered 16 riders. 0.2 seconds at 100 mile an hour is about 5 to 10 feet, if that. And, you know, to cover 16 riders over that distance is nothing. And going around the track at all at the same speed, all different riders on all different manufacturers of bikes, it makes good competition. And in a way, I'm probably sad to be leaving World Superbikes because the competition is so good and so strong.
You're only going to spend 1 year in the series. Now you're moving on to MotoGP. Are you surprised that it is that you've just been that you've, you know, 1 year and you've gotten called up to the big show?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, it's an honour to be asked, and it just shows that what Yamaha are doing is working. You know, they did it with me after, well, with Ben and me. They signed Ben to World Superbike, they signed me to Super Sport, they then signed Ben to MotoGP and me to World Superbike, and now they're signing Ben to the factory team in MotoGP and me to the satellite team. So really it's working fantastic with what they're doing, and trying to bring riders through. And now they've signed Eugene Laverty for World Superbike. You know, they've brought him from Super Sport, obviously not with Yamaha, but I think they're trying to build a good base for young riders to come through and look for the future. They've got Lorenzo in the main team as well, and it's a nice story, you know, to come through from them for winning the Super Sport title to doing well in Superbikes, and now to move into MotoGP with them in sort of 3 years is a fantastic achievement. And yeah, very surprised, but an honour to be asked, really.
You've raced here just once at Miller Motorsports Park, and I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you, what are your thoughts about our facility and the track here and the event here this year?
I love it. You know, it's nice to come there. And do you know what I always said I love about coming to Miller, even when I raced Supersport last year and Superbike this year? The fans, you know, they pop you going out of the pit lane, and you know, you haven't even started your race, you haven't even done anything, and they're always so supportive. So coming to that track on Supersport, it was absolutely fantastic. Superbike was quite hard work going through the chicanes and all the attitudes, and you know, moving the bike from side to side with 220 odd horsepower is hard work, but a great facility, and nice to come there 2 years in a row and be on the podium. So shame I won't be coming there in MotoGP, but you know, there's always time to come back in World Superbike, I'm sure, towards the end of my career, and I'll be there doing something, I'm sure.
How does Miller compare to other tracks that are on the championship schedule?
I quite like it because, you know, you normally have a track that's either fast or it's either slow. Miller's a bit of both, really. You know, you've got fast straight, that sixth gear on a superbike, and then you've got the first 3-4 corners, and especially the one leading onto the little back straight before the hairpin there. That's like fourth, fifth gear wide open on a superbike. So it's not easy. But then again, you know, you've got, as I said, the attitudes where you're changing direction so fast and it's up and down. It compares a lot different. It's a lot different to European tracks, but in a very good way, because you get a bit of everything. And as you saw this year, you know, it suited every bike. There was three different manufacturer of bikes on the podium, and it's good. It equals things out quite a lot. I'd say it was a really, really good Ducati circuit. But then again, you know, our bike's got good top end, and the Aprilia's got good top end, and they were, you know, they won the race and we were third. So unfortunate for Carlos this year on the Ducati, but a nice circuit all around.
All right, well, we appreciate that. Operator, if you don't mind, let's go ahead and open it up to the callers.
Now, now that you're moving in the satellite team and GP, what plans do you have before next season to train yourself both mentally and physically for MotoGP racing?
Yeah, I think, God, you know, Superbike's completely different to MotoGP. You know, you've got a bike that we're riding at the minute that's 174 kilos, and I'm going to be riding something that's like around 150 kilos next year. So losing a little bit of muscle for me isn't going to be a problem. I think dropping 4 or 5 kilos from what I am now, which is what I was in Supersport last year, my weight is actually, body fat wise, is the same. But just I put on muscle from riding the superbike because it's heavier and more power than what I was used to last year. So I'll drop exactly back down to what I was last year on Supersport. My training really won't change. I'll probably do it from not riding a superbike. You know, the weight will drop off from just not riding that superbike. So I'll just continue what I'm doing. And obviously there's only one race today in MotoGP. But it seems to be the big difference in MotoGP at the minute is what's working for them, is how light they are and how much they put into things, you know, with regards to their diets and sort of, as you said, being a bit robotic with things. But that's what makes a difference. That's what I'll have to do, and I'm looking forward to doing it.
All right, and then you did well on the Honda during the British Championship, but when you landed on the Yamaha, you've really begin getting some excellent results, including your World Supersport title in 2009. What is it about the Yamaha that fits you so well?
I don't know. I think it's everything. They're such a good manufacturer for Eiffel, and I've always said that they're like riding for a family, a lot more than the other manufacturers that I've been with in the past, and Lawrence, and when I had Wilco Zeelenberg, and that, they just look after you, as I said, just like a family, and it's nice. You don't, they know how I work and I know how they work, and I respect that, and they respect, you know, what I do, and I'll always put the best in. But no, I think riding for Yamaha for me, it was a great move, and now, you know, I'll be going into my third year with them next year, and obviously I've got a 2-year deal, so I'll be riding for 4 years in the end, and it's an honour to do so, and I just think I fit with the whole Yamaha brand in general, and it's made things in my life easy from a riding point of view.
Excellent. And nothing else to add about your Silverstone race. I mean, that was an awesome performance this year. Is that your favorite track on the schedule?
No, I don't really think it is. I think it was just, you know, we went there with everyone else not having settings from last year, and it was an open field for everyone, you know, a new circuit, and we managed to go there and do really well, and to go to a home event, as Ben did last year at Miller, and for me to go to Silverstone and do well was superb. I had, you know, both fastest laps, pole position, and two race wins, so I couldn't have got a better weekend at all, and it was nice to do it at home, and I just think, you know, we went there with high hopes, and every British rider wanted to win, but I think I just wanted it a little bit more than everyone else.
Awesome. So what is your favorite track so far?
It's hard to say. It's really, really hard to say, but I was just saying earlier that if there's a circuit I can't wait to get to next year, it's got to be Laguna, you know, because I've never rode there, and I've seen so much about it on TV, and everyone goes on about a corkscrew and stuff like that. It'd be good to go there on a MotoGP bike for the first time. But at the minute, favourite track, probably Brno. I quite like Brno as a circuit. I don't necessarily go the best there. I just quite like it. It's a good layout of the circuit. And, you know, I have to say Miller was good this year, especially on the superbike. What's probably most fun on a supersport bike is Monza, just because everything's flat out. You know, really shoot off the most of the corners. I'd say this year I've had some good races at some circuits I like, but you have to like all the circuits. That's the problem. You can't go to a circuit thinking that you don't like it because you won't do very well at it. It's simple as that.
Hi, Cal.
Hi.
Hey, Have you ever had the opportunity to test a MotoGP bike in the past? And if so, what were your impressions?
I actually rode the original bike end of 2006. I only did about 10 laps on it at Valencia because I signed for that British Superbike team for the following year. They let me have a little go. It was the last year of the 990, actually. So that was an enjoyable thing to jump on and have a go. And I had a go on Hopkins' bike. But funnily enough, I've always said it, and I still stick by what I said. They're not as powerful off the corner as a superbike. Mm-hmm. They haven't got the torque that you would think they really have. And you have to keep them above 10,000 revs. When I rode that one, you have to keep it really, really high revving, or else it wheeled so much. But I didn't really have a full test on it, but I rode it enough to know, you know, the difference between a superbike and a MotoGP bike in that short space of time. I think, you know, now the thing for 800cc, I think it's going to be a little bit different. But no, I think it was an enjoyable experience for me. I was only 18 years old or something, jumping on a MotoGP bike and having to fly around Valencia. So. Next year's going to be cool, and I'll get to ride in less than a month's time anyway, so I'm looking forward to riding the bike.
Yeah, the conventional wisdom has kind of been for the last couple of years that superbike riders don't make good MotoGP riders, but I think maybe partly due to Ben, that kind of seems to be changing, and now with you coming along, do you think that's just kind of an old wives' tale, or do you think it is a little bit, it's going to take some work to adapt?
Yeah, it's going to be 100%. It's going to take a work to adapt, and I've got to learn that open-minded and humble, and be willing to work, which is me all over. I'll go in there and be willing to work, no problem, to get the results we need. But as you said, Ben threw that theory out the window when he's jumped in there as a superbike rider for the last four or five years, and gone in there and done fantastically well. So. That theory has gone out the window, I think, and I don't necessarily think it's about superbike riders can't do it. I think it's about the riders that are getting on, if they can do it or not, and if they want to do it. And Ben's shown that he's got the determination to do it, and he's done a fantastic job. So I think if I can go in there with the same attitude he's got, then I'll go in there and do well as well. Hopefully that'll come to fruition, and then we'll do good in the first year.
Do you think that the second year, when they switch to 1000s, will that be a better fit, or is it just a different deal?
I've always said that going now is the perfect time to go, because I've got a year learning the circuits and a year learning the team and a MotoGP bike, and then the second year, everyone's got to start learning again, so I'm already a step a little bit closer, you know, because they've all got to start learning the thousands again, and the people who wasn't on thousands before have got to learn. So, you know, I'll already be that little bit step closer to, you know, to not... It's just, I think it's going to make it easier in the second year, because everyone's got to learn as well, and I'll be still learning, you know. Along with them.
All right, thanks very much.
No problem, thanks very much.
Thank you. The next question comes from Paul Nielsen of Motor World Podcast.
Good morning, Callan. Thanks for your time today.
No problem, thanks very much.
Hey, where are you, by the way?
In the Isle of Man.
When we talked with, we talked to somebody a while back, you guys were all over there. What a nice place.
Yeah. We have a good crack over here. We go out every day in the morning, either cycling, running, and then in the afternoons always enduro with David Knight or motocross or trials riding. So we have a fantastic time over here as well as living here. Always tax benefits as well.
That's great. Hey, listen, you just was excuse me. You were just talking with Chris John at Road Racer X. And the question, you said, you know, getting used to your new team when you go into MotoGP. And how do you feel about that? Are you bringing somebody with you from Superbike into GP? And how do you feel about coming into the new team and following in behind Ben?
I'm really looking forward to it. I am going to be taking someone with me. I'll be taking my crew chief from this year and last year, the one that I won the World Supersport title with, and my crew chief now, his name's Markus Eschenbacher, a German guy who's been employed by Yamaha for years. And it'll be good for me to take someone with me. Crew chiefs over there don't get to do the stuff that they get to do in World Superbike, like the inventions and being able to try so much stuff because of how much he's governed by the Japanese. But he's still a fantastic organizer and he knows the way I work. So I'm not worried about sliding into a team. I know Hervé quite well, and Hervé's a good guy as it is. He runs a fantastic team, and even if I couldn't take my own guy with me, I'm sure I'd be fine anyway. But I'm not worried about sliding into the team. As for going in, sort of in Ben's seat, it's going to be an honour to do so. He's done a fantastic job, and he did a brilliant job in World Superbike as well. He won the title in the first year, and not many people can say that they've gone and done that, and it's a very, very good achievement. And to go into MotoGP and do what he's done already as a rookie is superb. So going in there is not going to be easy, but I think everybody knows how good Ben is, and he takes everything in his stride. And if I can go in there with the same sort of attitude as I said earlier on, I think I'll do good if I can do the same as what he's doing, mentally, mental-wise and riding-wise.
Well, you both have worked your way up, quite quickly in this, and you too, you have had great successes in your own right. So not to put anything, to Ben or to put you in his shadow, I don't mean to do that. But at the same time, it's the organization with Yamaha is moving you guys along real quickly. Who have you had along your way, super sport, super bike, that has helped you other than your crew chief, but other people in there that have helped you? For example, Ben had Colin Edwards, and who is one of the great development riders around. Who have you had along with you over these years to, keep moving you, helping you?
In general, and still next year, I couldn't really say as much this year. Well, I can in a way, and I can say it for next year as well, but definitely last year, because he's my team manager as well, Klaus Ehlenberg. Jorge Lorenzo's team manager from this year in MotoGP, my team manager from last year, and he's still going to be Jorge Lorenzo's team manager next year, but he was influential in my move to MotoGP as well, and for my move to Yamaha World Superbike. So as an aspect of riding-wise, and still, I talk to him on a daily basis, really, with regards to stuff at Yamaha, with bikes and with setup, and, just general attitude towards racing. He's been there and done it before, and he knows what he's looking for, and I would say Wilco, definitely.
Wonderful. Okay, my last question then today will be, in your off-season coming up, besides, all the training and the things that you're going to have to do trying to get all set up and testing for MotoGP, what are you going to do just for your own, travel-wise, just on your own? What are you going to go do in the off-season?
I don't know.
Just for
playing. I can't necessarily do it on my own because my girlfriend will tell me I've got to take her on holiday, I suppose, because we haven't had too much of a break with a busy schedule this year. But I love motocross, I love jet skiing, and, I love doing my own thing. And I keep myself to myself, but I enjoy that, and that's why I'm able to come into to race weekends focused, because I know I've put the effort in the week on my own and done everything right preparation-wise to go into a race weekend. But I suppose over the winter I'll be over to America a little bit because it's warmer over there. I'll go over and see Bob Moore, my manager Bob Moore, over in San Diego, and come and watch some AMA Supercross races.
Wonderful. Well, Cal, congratulations on your move to MotoGP with the Monster Yamaha Tech 3 team, and you've had a great season this year, and I look forward to seeing you at Laguna Seca next summer.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. Much appreciated.
Thank you for your time.
Hi, Cal. How you doing?
Yeah, good. Thank you, yourself.
Good. When you get to Laguna, watch out for turn 5. It's a doozy.
Okay.
There's a little mythology about Valentino Rossi testing your bike at Brno and, you know, finding some sort of magical setting. Was there some truth to that? Did you guys get some insights?
Yeah, you know, I'll be truthful about it. Everybody says, especially the Italian press, say Valentino turned the bike around and then we went and won on it. But that's not necessarily the case because Valentino Rossi wasn't riding the bike. Yeah, he helped out, definitely. His setup-wise was completely different to mine because he's taller, he's a similar weight, but he rides the bike completely different. But for me, what he did do was he really, really helped with a setting off the bottom of the engine, you know, just opening the throttle the first 15%. He put a wet mat in the bike and just used that just to make the bike a lot more smoother and less aggressive. We went to Silverstone and we did use it, and I found it helped. And, you know, that's why Valentino Rossi is the best rider in the world, or, you know, has been the best rider in the world for, I'd say, sort of over the last 10 years. If you look at what he's been able to do, he's definitely been the man to beat and the most recognised motorcycle racer ever, really. So for him to ride the bike and give some input was an honour, and it was nice to sort of hear his comments on riding the R1.
And are you applying some of those settings now for the rest of the season?
No, as I said, he only did that one wet map off the bottom of the engine for the first 15%. And yeah, I've used it ever since. But the bike still does the same stuff. It just helps with the softness of coming off the corner. But it was a lot easier for Valentino Rossi to come in and say, you know, for it to be changed. And then the guys sort of listened and done it straight away. When he rode it, he was good. He was on the pace, and it was nice for him to come in and ride it around Brno, especially straight after the weekend that we'd raced. He got around to some competitive lap times, and I think he enjoyed riding Superbike. I think he said afterwards he really, really liked it.
Yep, I think he said a couple of times that he might like to give it a try. And then the follow-up to the whole preparation for MotoGP, have you talked to James Tolson about it? Are you guys concentrating mostly on this season still, or have you pegged him for maybe some advice?
No, I don't really speak to James about that. And I wouldn't really speak to him about it. I think, you know, I'd speak to someone who's now in GP, and that'll probably be Colin. If, you know, if Colin stays as teammate next year, it'll be Colin or it'll be Ben. But as I said in the last part of this interview, speaking with Wilco Zeelandbouw is probably one of the key things. You know, now team manager Fiat Yamaha knows a lot about the bikes already, and I don't speak to James. I think, you know, obviously he's a good rider. He went to MotoGP and doing well in the first few races, and but I want to. I want to do my own thing. I ride completely different to James, and I don't really know if his advice would work or not. But I'll take any advice that I can, and hopefully go in there with high hopes for next season.
Cool. So you're probably ready for your Colin Edwards mancation?
Yeah, you know, that's. I think he's had Ben a little bit this year. You know, I don't think Ben really needed too much help from Colin because of how well he's been riding, and Ben's a fantastic rider, so, you know, obviously I think he did help him a little bit, and with Colin's experience of riding M1 Yamahas over the years, it's always going to help, and any advice I can get given off Colin, I'll be taking, and I look forward to working with him.
Okay, thanks a lot, Cal, and good luck for the rest of the season.
Brilliant, thanks very much, Chief.
Cal, you mentioned Valentino riding the World Superbike, and I think the word was that you were one of the riders that was offered the chance to ride his bike when he was injured as a wild card. Is that true? And if so, why did you decide to pass it up?
It was true. definitely true, and I got a formal request off Yamaha to do so. But I passed it up because there was a career thought in it, and I think it's probably one of the best decisions I've ever made, and Yamaha respected the decision and why I did it. I wanted to do it, and to be offered to ride in replace of Valentino was an honour. But, you know, they wanted me to go to three circuits I've never been to, and I wasn't allowed to test the bike because MotoGP rules state no testing, and there was no time for me to test the bike at that point of the season. Mm-hmm. So they wanted me to go to Catalunya was the first one.
Yeah,
they wanted me to go to, which is basically an hour of free practice on the Friday afternoon. I've never ridden a MotoGP bike as such. You know, obviously I said I rode the Disney bike for 10 laps, but I haven't ridden an 800cc MotoGP bike. I've never ridden on Bridgestone tyres. I've never ridden on carbon discs. And it seems to me that the Bridgestone tyres are catching everyone out. Now, you can't just jump in there and just go into a 45-minute free practice on a Friday afternoon. And I think Yamaha respected that decision. I didn't want to get hurt. I wanted to continue in World Superbike. And they were asking me to stop World Superbike and do MotoGP. And I said no to that because I'd already started World Superbike and why would I stop? And, I think it was a good decision. And, you know, as I said, it'll come back around. And it did. And, you know, I'm going to be riding it in less than a month's time. So, and I'm going to be on the bike for next year. And it was an opportunity that I passed at the time, but I've got given a great opportunity for next year now.
That makes sense. I know the UK is really hungry to have a competitive MotoGP rider. Do you feel any kind of pressure or responsibility in that regard?
Yeah, there's always big pressure. And, you know, I stated last week in over here for a newspaper over here, and, you know, I want to be the best British MotoGP rider there's been in recent times, you know, because there'd be no point in me going into it if I didn't want to be that. And, there'd be no point in me lining up on the grid if I didn't want to be the best. You know, you go into a race to win. You go into a championship to do well. And if I had no ambition, then I'd be stupid to be even turning up to the race meeting. So, of course, you know, I think the character of MotoGP riders that have been out of Britain haven't done so well. You know, and all have ended up back in World Superbike quite quickly or whatever. I think, you know, I want to stay in MotoGP and do well, and I've got the determination and the mental attitude to do so, and I think I've got here quite fast, so I've had the determination and ambition to do that, so, you know, there's no reason why I shouldn't have it to do well in MotoGP in the end.
That's good. And my last question is just taking it back to World Superbike again a little bit.
Yep.
And just wanted to ask your perspective on the Ducati's decision to pull out the factory team. And I know it's something you're not directly involved in, but maybe that would give you the opportunity to be more candid than some others might be.
I think everybody's really involved with it, you know. Certainly I wasn't too involved with it, but it's a decision that's made and it's affected everyone, because how does a manufacturer of that caliber just manage to pull out? You know, it's bad for everyone, and it's disappointing for everyone, because over the years, how many championships they've had and how many race wins they've had, and now, you know, the series has lost a factory team. It's disappointing, and it'll be sad to see them go. But I think you still see Ducatis at the front with the privateer teams. It's just disappointing that the factory guys are not going to be there, and it's not going to be a full red Ducati team anymore, as it's always been. But, you know, I think they'll be able to prove a point in these last four races, so we need to up our game as well. Everyone does.
Right, thank you.
No problem, thanks.
Hey, Cal, so, you know, the Yamaha M1, you said you really like the Yamaha brand, and I don't know, is it just the bike itself that, like, the R1 and the R6 that you kind of grown to like?
Not necessarily. In a way, I don't like the R1. I like riding my 600. It's the best bike I've ever ridden, and I think I'll go down in, you know, for as long as I race, is probably one of the best bikes I've ever ridden, and such a nice bike to ride. The R1 is difficult to ride, and I've always found how Ben won a championship on it last year. It was incredible. And I think certain Wayne Gardner said it as well. And I think a lot of people that have rode the bike is journalists and, you know, ex-racers have said the same thing. So it's quite a hard bike to ride, you know. So I like the company. The company's a fantastic brand, and they do everything right, and they try to make things right. It's been a difficult year for us this year, as it was for Ben last year, with regards to getting stuff for the Superbike. But I think as we look at the economy, it's difficult to have a factory team at the moment in MotoGP and in World Superbike. If you look at the minute, there's no factory team in both. Next year, there'll be no factory team in both. You know, obviously, the Honda outfit in MotoGP's factory, the Honda outfit in World Superbike is with Tenkate, the Suzuki outfit in GP's factory, and the Suzuki outfit in World Superbike is with Astara. So, you know, it's difficult to get the company to focus on Superbike and try and get stuff out of them for that, because MotoGP takes up so much budget and so much time. It's difficult for that, but I like Yamaha because they'll always put any effort in you can get, you know, no matter what it is, they'll try their hardest with the resources that they've got, and it's quite relaxed at Yamaha. It's very, very professional, but relaxed in a way where they make the riders feel welcome, and they'll do anything to help you.
It's definitely a company that values the riders. You know, the M1 has a reputation for being one of the most adjustable bikes, which sometimes can be a little overwhelming. How is your crew chief going to be preparing for that?
Yeah, I think looking at data from Jorge is very possible because of the link with Wilco Zeelenberg, and Wilco was the team manager last year with the crew chief. And, you know, I think he knows my settings, he knows what I like, and I know my GP bike's different, but he knows, you know, the way I ride and what I would need, because owners will have things that you can convert over. You know, they'll know what Superbike setting will fit into a MotoGP bike. It'll be completely different springs and head angles and stuff like that, but, you know, they know what works. And going from having Valentino Rossi riding the bike for six years, seven years, you know, he developed that bike into something quite phenomenal, of a bike that will go to most race circuits and be fast no matter what. And that's the good thing about moving into MotoGP with Yamaha, is moving into a bike that works in most circuits as it is.
Yeah, it's probably one of the best bikes on the grid, so should be fun riding that thing. So good luck, and thank you again.
All right, well, we appreciate everybody participating this morning, and we particularly appreciate Cal taking the time to be with us today. We wish you success in the remaining races in the World Superbike calendar, and we look forward to seeing you on the grid in MotoGP next year. So thanks very much.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
And thanks, everybody, and have a good day.
All right. Once again, Jules, thanks so much for catching that for me. I was in a meeting and I wasn't able to take care of it. So we got a little bit of information there from Cal, and he was certainly forthcoming. And I'll see if I can't get him on a one-to-one pretty quick. I think that's about it, Martin, but I did kind of want to comment and fill me in on your thoughts as well. Back to another Spanish round, a new round at a new track. And you got to think that there's a couple of Spanish riders that are certainly going to be in the top in many classes this weekend. It could be a Spanish sweep if you think about it.
Yeah, and there was a bit of number crunching going on. I believe I'm right. This is off the top of my head. If Lorenzo scores a podium this weekend, the only other rider who will be able to catch him is Pedrosa, which means for the first time since Alex Crivier, we're guaranteed a Spanish MotoGP champion. Hmm. So they'll be quite excited about that, I think. So far, he hasn't been off the podium in any race at all. I mean, for just consistency, you know, the boy's done good. But like you say, we could be looking at MotoGP, Moto2, and a 125 Spanish clean sweep, and they certainly are the predominant nation at the moment.
Yeah, if you're going to end up with a clean sweep at a Spanish track, you might as well put it out in the middle of the desert where there isn't a whole lot of stuff to burn down, because that crowd is going to go nuts.
Yeah.
It should be pretty cool. You kind of wonder, kind of still waiting for a couple of guys that are on injured reserve. Rossi, not so much. It seems like he's coming back. And, you know, this certainly would be a race that he would want to come in and not allow either Jorge or Danny to put their stamp on it, if you will.
Yeah.
Because that would set a bad precedent, right? Especially for next year as well. So, you know, we're really going to have to see. In fact, there is an awful lot to prove for the Spanish riders to actually do that, to you know, plant your mark, plant your flag, as Jorge might. That will be an interesting battle.
And if Ben Spies is going to win a race this year, this might be his best opportunity, because let's face it, he has proved he is good at unknown tracks.
Well, not only unknown tracks, but also tracks of this ilk, because this track really has been compared to Portimao, and that is a track that he loves. I would love to hand him a styrofoam cup and see what he would make out of this thing. I've looked at the outline, and it's kind of like a lizard skulking along the ground, but you know, I think he'd probably be a little bit more vocal about it. Anyway, certainly a whole bunch of fun. We're tailing off on the BSB season is sort of winding down. We're getting the same direction. We're heading into fall, cooler weather, and the anticipation continues to build as the seasons wind down, and also the kind of creeping fear and dread that the last race will run and will be like, oh, Christ, what do we do now? But regardless, as long as it's going on, we will bring you plenty and plenty, and certainly we'll do the same thing in the off season. Martin, thank you so much for getting up with us this morning.
Well, thank you for staying up, old chap, and I hope your cold disappears as soon as possible.
Certainly so. Enjoy your checkout today, and try not to giggle too much at the other pilots performing aerial faux pas.
Exactly, yes. Thanks very much again, Jim, and have a great weekend, everyone. And we'll be back next week to talk about Aragon.
Indeed. Ciao.
Good night.
Oh, wait, no, that's adios, isn't it? Cheers.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.
Are you there?
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.